Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 96.
Teng Monk and his disciples are continuing their epic pilgrimage.
Okay.
The scene itself is bathed in this kind of tranquility. It's that beautiful transition from spring into early summer. The text paints this picture of clear and harmonious weather.
Yeah, lovely details.
With lotuses blooming in ponds, plums ripening after rain, wheat growing strong in the wind. We get the gentle hum of nature, old nightingales singing, light willow branches swaying.
Swallows carrying chicks, mountain pheasants feeding their young. It's very idyllic.
It really is. A long day, filled with this general sense of all things displaying their brilliance.
You know, this isn't just scenic filler, is it? This tranquil setting, so rich with natural abundance and peace, it almost feels like a profound shift.
How so?
Like in the universe's alignment, maybe.
Yeah.
After all the perils and hardships they face, this unexpected harmony seems to suggest a kind of spiritual openness.
Hmm.
A divine preparation, perhaps, for the heaven-sent encounter that's coming.
Hmm. The calm before a uniquely positive revelation.
Exactly. It says they've been on safe roads for about half a month, just, you know, navigating the routine day in, day out, morning meals, easing stays.
And then they spot it. A city wall approaching. Teng Monk, always the one concerned with where they're headed, asks his disciples, what place is this?
Right, and this is where we get that great glimpse into their dynamic.
Definitely. Sun Wukong, the usually all-knowing Monkey King, responds with an unexpected, I don't know, I don't know.
Which is kind of funny.
It is. He explains he only ever flew over these paths way up in the clouds, never actually landed, so he just never paid attention.
That raises a pretty interesting point about perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wukong's usual method, you know, traversing the world at high speed, way above the ground, means he totally misses these crucial ground-level details.
Sure.
It really highlights the difference between that bird's-eye view and the tactile, on-the-ground experience the monk and the others are living through.
Is there a lesson there, maybe about the value of different kinds of knowledge? Or even humility, perhaps?
Could be. Different approaches to the journey.
And Zhu Buji, Pigsy, he can't resist teasing him, can he? Laughing that Wukong is being peculiar trying to trick them.
Yeah. Wukong gets a bit defensive, of course. Clarifies it just wasn't his job to investigate while he was flying.
Classic banter. It shows their camaraderie, but it also grounds them as they enter this new unknown place.
As they cross the drawbridge and enter the city gate, Teng Monk's immediate concern is, well, decorum.
Always.
He spots two old men chatting in a corridor. And straight away tells his disciples to stand humbly in the street, heads bowed, stressing not to be presumptuous.
That unwavering adherence to protocol, it really speaks volumes about him, doesn't it?
It does. So Teng Monk approaches the elders, joins his palms, politely asks for the place name, and, crucially, a charitable household for alms.
And the elders' reply is quite telling. They identify the location. Copper Terrace Prefecture, or Uftu with Earth Spirit County, behind it.
Those names themselves are pretty evocative, aren't they? Copper Terrace suggesting solidity, maybe a foundation built on spiritual effort.
And Earth Spirit County reinforcing that connection to the land, hinting at the, well, almost faded nature of this meeting.
Indeed. But they don't just point to any old house. They direct the monks to a very specific one.
They immediately say, go to Old Man Cru's place, Koyuan Way. They even describe it, tiger-seated gatehouse, and this really specific sign, no monks refused, one sembuzu.
And it's worth noting here that Yuanwei is a title. It signifies a wealthy landowner or a local gentry, which is key to understanding his capacity for generosity later.
Good point. His home is on the north-south street facing east.
Then the elders, almost dismissively, tell the monks to hurry up so they can get back to their own chat.
Yeah, about rise and fall, who is saintly and who is worthy, and where are the heroic deeds of the past. It's almost like they're saying, hey, you're interrupting our important worldly discussion here.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it sets up this dynamic, this contrast. The worldly concerns the elders versus the spiritual journey the monks are on.
Hmm. The elders are fixated on history and power.
While the monks are focused on this living, evolving spiritual quest, so as the monks proceed down the long street, the market people are described as startled and alarmed, suspicious and doubtful.
Understandable, given their appearance.
They gather around to stare. And Teng Monk, again, reminds his disciples to remain humble, reinforcing their role as respectful pilgrims, not be presumptuous.
So they soon find it the tiger-seated gatehouse and that unmistakable...
And inside, yep, there's the sign. No monks refused.
And that sign, no monks refused, it's really significant, isn't it? It says a lot about this area, this Western Buddhist land. Tang Monk, ever the faithful one, expresses his belief in the honesty of these Western Buddhist lands, confirming what the elders said. It's a powerful moment of affirmation for him, you can imagine.
Absolutely. Now, Zubaji, true to form.
Oh, yeah.
He's eager to just rush right in.
Of course he is.
But Sun Wukong, showing his, you know, seasoned wisdom now, advises caution. He suggests they wait for someone to come out and ask first. Avoid causing trouble.
And Sha Wujing agrees. The sensible one.
Ever the sensible one. He agrees with Wukong's wisdom.
You know, that's more than just a pause, isn't it? It shows a real evolution in how they work together.
Definitely. They've learned to navigate the world with more prudence, better teamwork. It's a testament to their long journey together.
And this strategic patience, it pays off immediately. A servant, a Kang Tu, that means a low-ranking household servant, comes out carrying a scale and a basket.
Okay.
Sees the monks, panics, drops everything, and runs inside yelling to his master that four strange monks have arrived.
Huh. Not the calmest reaction.
Not quite, but Ku Yuanwai's reaction is truly remarkable. We learn he is Ku Hong, courtesy name Daquan, 64 years old.
Okay.
And he's deeply devout. He's found just strolling in his courtyard reciting Buddhist scriptures.
Ah, so he's actively practicing.
Exactly. When he hears the news, he immediately drops his crutch and rushes out to welcome them. No fear, no judgment about their, quote, ugly appearance.
None at all.
None. He just keeps repeating, please come in, please come in. It's this welcome rooted in pure, unwavering devotion. Mm. Such a contrast to the suspicious market people just outside.
That's quite striking. He doesn't hesitate, doesn't judge their looks. His immediate joyful response tells you so much about his character and his spiritual commitment.
Totally. He leads them through an alleyway to an upper house, explaining these are the guest quarters, a Buddhist hall, a scripture hall, and a dining hall. His family lives in the lower house.
Smart setup.
Tang Monk is deeply impressed by such a dedicated setup, praises the thoughtfulness.
And this Buddhist hall, the description is just exquisite. A true sanctuary.
It really is. Filled with dense, fragrant clouds, bright candle flames, brocade and flowers gathered, gold and color splendid.
It lists red lacquer racks hanging purple gold bells, painted lacquer stands with carved drums, embroidered eight treasures, thousands of golden Buddhas.
Ancient bronze censers and vases, carved lacquer tables and boxes. Incense is constantly burning. Lotus flowers always display their color.
It's more than just rich decoration, isn't it? Every single detail, from the constant incense to the sheer number of golden Buddhas, it reinforces the scale and the profound commitment behind his vow.
This isn't just wealth.
No, it's sanctified wealth.
Yeah.
Consecrated to a higher purpose. The text calls the hall a treasure tower untouched by red dust, and a family temple outshining even grand monasteries.
An oasis of devotion, truly. After worshiping, Tang Monk prepares to formally greet Ku Yuanwai, but then he's led to the scripture hall.
Ah, right. And if the Buddhist hall showed his spiritual practice,
then the scripture hall reveals the, well, the profound intellectual and scholarly depth of his devotion. What does this level of commitment to learning tell us about him, and maybe about the ideal of a truly devout Buddhist in this time?
Well, it tells us he's not just a generous benefactor. He's a genuine scholar of the Dharma.
Right.
This hall has square tables and vertical cabinets just stacked with countless scriptures, and jade boxes and golden cases storing many scrolls.
Wow.
Painted lacquer tables hold exquisite writing implements, paper, ink, brushes, inkstones. There's a pepper-scented screen displaying calligraphy paintings, zither, and chess, embodying subtle and profound true tastes.
So it's a place where wisdom is actively cultivated, preserved, ensuring his quest goes beyond just charity.
Exactly. The atmosphere itself is described as transformative, clear air refreshing the spirit, and a fasting heart naturally feeling at peace.
This man has literally created a spiritual haven within his own home. Pretty remarkable.
It is. And this brings us to the moment where all the pieces just spectacularly align. After Tang Monk removes his cassock and introduces the disciples, Ku Yuanwai reveals his lifelong vow.
This is it. The big reveal.
This is the critical revelation.
At age 40, he made this incredible vow to host 10,000 monks. 10,000.
Yeah, that's a lifetime commitment.
Seriously, and he says he's been doing it for 24 years straight. He even has a ledger.
He checks the book, meticulously keeping a ledger, a record of every single monk he's hosted.
Incredible focus.
His recent calculation showed he had hosted exactly 9,996 monks. He needed only four more to complete his vow.
Only four, and then?
And then, Tangbrook and his three disciples arrive at his gate.
The perfect, undeniable four. It's almost unbelievable.
He exclaims that their arrival is heaven sent, perfectly completing his vow of 10,000 monks. It's just a moment of pure, profound synchronicity.
You can just imagine the feeling. Kuyuanwe is so overjoyed, he asks them to stay for over a month to celebrate completing the vow.
A big celebration.
And it gets even better. After the celebration, he promises to provide sedan chairs and horses to send them on their way to Spirit Mountain. And he notes it's only 800 li and not far.
Which, for context, is roughly 250 miles. Given the epic journey they've been on, that really isn't that far, relatively speaking.
Right. Tang Monk, understandably, is very happy and readily agrees to this incredible, totally unexpected arrangement. Kuyuanwe, described as deeply devout, and he's genuinely thrilled, tells his household right away, you know, prepare a feast for these heaven-sent monks. Kuyuanwe's wife.
The source tells us she's pretty startled, maybe even a bit afraid by the disciples' appearances. You know, Sun Wukong, Zubaji. They're described as ugly or unusual.
Right. Not exactly conventional looking.
Not at all. But almost immediately, her perspective just flips. She concludes that their strange kind of ancient forms must mean their heavenly beings descended to the mortal world.
Wow, quite a leap.
It is, and it uniquely highlights this human tendency for, well, immediate bias based on appearance, doesn't it? Even for someone devout like her.
Yeah, that's a great point. It shows how ingrained those first impressions are.
Exactly. Even while her devotion kind of compels a second, more profound interpretation later on.
And as if to really drive home that initial shock for the old woman, our friend Zubaji, well, he makes quite an entrance.
Oh, you mean his voice?
Yeah. The source says his booming voice was so loud it was like a tiger's roar in a deep mountain. Must have startled her even more.
I bet. And that this quick pivot, you know, from fear to reverence that the source documents, it serves as a really powerful example of how preconceptions can be challenged.
That's true.
What initially frightens or surprises can, well, upon closer inspection, reveal something profound or even divine, at least within this story's context. Sort of a reminder to look beyond the surface.
A theme we see again and again in the journey, hashtag intellectual curiosity, and the grand scale of the journey.
Definitely. So as the monks start to settle in a bit, the scene shifts. It's a different kind of encounter now.
Okay.
Kuyuanwe's two young sons, their scholars, Kuliang and Kudong, they arrive home from their studies.
Ah, the educated sons.
Precisely. And the sources describe their immediate, very respectful deference to Tang Sanzong. They bow low before him. Their respect for his spiritual stature is really clear.
And how does Sanzong react?
Well, his response to their education is particularly telling. I think. He quotes this line, Dia Xu Huo.
Okay. And yeah. What's the gist of that?
It basically translates to excellent, excellent. If you want your family to flourish, do good deeds. If you want good descendants, make them study.
Ah, so it connects doing good with education for future success.
Exactly. This really underscores a crucial value system here. The link between a family's success and cultivating both, you know, moral conduct and intellectual pursuit.
And the sons, being scholars, they don't just stop at bowing, right? They lean into that.
They do. They show this real intellectual curiosity. They actually start questioning Tang Sanzong about the four great continents.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and they even reference a specific text, the Shilin Guangji, which was like a known encyclopedia of the time.
So they knew their stuff.
Seems like it. They know they're in this West Nie continent, and they ask about South Jambuzhipa, which is where Sanzang came from.
And then the big question.
And then the big one.
Yeah.
How many ages? Or essentially, how long is this epic journey actually taken?
And Sanzang's answer really hits home, doesn't it?
It really does. His candor is striking. He admits he spent more days delayed by obstacles than actually traveling.
Wow.
Constantly encountering poisonous demons and fierce monsters, enduring myriad hardships and 10,000 difficulties. It sounds exhausting.
Unbelievably so. And he credits his disciples.
Absolutely. He specifically credits his three disciples for protecting him over 14 periods of cold and heat, which means 14 full years.
14 years, just to get to this point.
Just to reach this place. The source portrays a journey that's not just about distance. I mean, it's about relentless struggle, immense resilience.
And the importance of his companions. You really feel that. 14 years. It's not just about individual effort, is it? It's also about adaptation, resilience, relying on others.
Well said. And speaking of being sustained, after these intellectual discussions, the scene shifts again.
Okay, where to now?
To the dinner table. Imagine this. The family invites the four monks to dine. And the sources, they provide such rich, really evocative details about the feast. It brings the whole thing to life.
I love these descriptions. What do they tell us?
Well, the setting itself speaks volumes. We hear about gold lacquer tables and black lacquer chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly opulent, meticulous care.
Fancy stuff.
Very. And the food is described with this almost poetic precision. The first row has five colors of high-quality fruits, all freshly arranged in fashionable styles by skilled craftsmen.
Wow, not just thrown in a bowl then.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It highlights this aesthetic appreciation, the sheer effort involved in honoring their guests. And then there are rows of small dishes, more fruit, snacks, all described as sweet and delicious, every item fragrant.
Sounds incredible. The generosity is palpable.
It really is. It signals this extraordinary level of respect Ku Yuan Wei has for them.
And it wasn't just like fancy finger foods, right? There were main courses too.
Oh, yes. For the main courses, they served plain soup with rice, plus steamed rolls and steamed buns.
Ah, proper food for hungry travelers.
Exactly. All described as spicy, hot and steaming, and completely delicious and truly filling. It's a mix of luxury and, you know, practical sustenance.
And the service, I imagine it was efficient.
Incredibly so. The sources detail 7 or 8 servants moving back and forth and 4 or 5 cooks working without stopping.
Wow, a hive of activity.
It paints this picture of highly organized, almost overwhelming generosity. It's like a hallmark of devotion in this context.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this vivid simile. The soup pourers poured soup. The rice servers added rice. Coming and going like shooting stars chasing the moon.
Like shooting stars chasing the moon. That's brilliant. Just constant, seamless service.
Exactly. And of course, our friend Zubaji gets a special mention again.
Naturally. How's he eating this time?
Eating one mouthful, one bowl, just inhaling it. With such speed, it's likened to wind sweeping away clouds.
You can just picture him. Glad they enjoyed it, though.
Oh, the sources confirm. The disciples and master enjoyed the meal immensely.
Mm-hmm.
#tag the virtue of perseverance and grand spiritual celebrations.
Okay, so after this, well, truly epic meal, Tang Sanzang, he's always focused on the quest, right? He wants to get back on the road.
Mm-hmm. Always the goal in mind.
But Ku Yuan Wei insists they stay. And here's where it gets really interesting. There's a powerful reason why.
There is. Ku Yuan Wei reveals he has spent, get this, 24 years completing a vow.
24 years. Wow. What was the vow?
To host 10,000 monks. And Sanzang and his disciples are basically the final guests needed to fulfill it. He needs them to stay for the big celebration marking its completion.
10,000 monks over 24 years. That's staggering commitment.
It really is. And he quotes that saying, San Silo.
Which means?
Roughly, as the saying goes, starting is easy, finishing is hard.
So true.
And this commitment, stretching over decades, it profoundly illustrates that virtue of seeing something through right to the very end. It's a testament to unwavering dedication.
So they have to stay for the party, basically.
Essentially, yes. A very significant, very spiritual party. And the scale of this celebration is, well, remarkable. Yongwei invites 24 local Buddhist monks.
Yeah.
And the preparations for this celebration of the 10,000 monk feast, they're so extensive they take 3 to 4 days just to organize and write everything out. They even choose a specific auspicious day for the ceremony itself.
Serious planning involved.
Very serious.
Mm.
And the sources detail this elaborate Buddhist ritual. It meticulously mirrors, you know, grand earthly celebrations, but with a deep spiritual focus.
What kind of things did they do?
Well, they raised large banners and laid out golden images. They held candles and burned incense for offerings. There was sound, too. Beating of drums and striking of cymbals, playing of zithers and plucking of pipes.
Quite the sensory experience.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Cloud gongs and horizontal flutes played clear notes. The whole description really highlights the profound spiritual diligence and the community devotion involved.
And the ritual itself, it had structure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It followed steps. Honoring local deities first, that inviting divine generals, issuing official documents, bowing to Buddha statues, it speaks to a very deeply ingrained spiritual practice, all designed to bring merit and protection.
And specific scriptures were involved too, right?
Yes, very specific. They discuss a volume of the Peacock Sutra, every sentence removing calamity and obstruction. They also lit a frame of medicine master lamps, every flame shining brightly.
Powerful stuff.
Indeed. And they performed the water repentance to resolve grievances, and recited the Avatamsaka Sutra to remove slander. A whole range of practices.
So it's this incredibly intricate sequence of ritual.
Exactly. All diligently performed. The text mentions the three vehicles of wonderful Dharma, different Buddhist paths or teachings, and emphasizes how one or two shaman all alike in their commitment. It really paints this vivid picture of a community united in profound spiritual dedication.
It's far more than just a feast, then. It's the culmination of a sacred duty spanning decades.
Tang Sanzang, his mind is just elsewhere.
Completely.
Right after a three-day Buddhist ritual, you'd think he'd want to relax after that, right? Enjoy the comfort. But no. The moment it's done, what's his first thought?
He wants to leave immediately for Leiyin Temple.
Right, the rush.
It's this deep, almost desperate urgency. It goes beyond just getting there. See, he made this solemn promise.
To the sacred monarch.
Exactly. To return within 3 years. It's now been 14 years since he left home.
Yes.
He's terrified about the consequences.
And he knows the journey back isn't short either.
No, he figures another 12 or 13 years just to get back with the scriptures.
Okay.
So this imperial deadline, it's everything to him right now.
Okay, so Tang Sanzang's got this massive pressure, this deadline in his head. But not everyone in his group is quite on the same page, are they?
Not even close. And this is where it gets really fun, character-wise.
Onto Pigsy.
Exactly. Pigsy has a very, very different perspective on leaving all this comfort behind.
What does he say? I imagine it's pretty direct.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Pigsy just comes right out and complains, calls the master's hurry inhumane, says he's not following people's wishes.
Huh. Following Pigsy's wishes, more like.
Pretty much. He points out Elder Ku is loaded. They've got all these ready-made good vegetarian meals just sitting there.
Mm.
Why go back to begging on the road?
It makes a certain kind of sense, I suppose.
For Pigsy, absolutely. He even suggests, hey, let's just stay for a year or so. What's the harm?
A year. And how does the very spiritual, very deadline-focused Tang Sanzang react to that?
Not well. He gets really angry, calls Pigsy a beast who only thinks about food and scratching his belly.
Ouch.
Yeah. He even threatens to just leave them all behind, go on alone if they're going to be so focused on greed and delusion.
Wow. So he really lays down the law. It's a serious spiritual discipline thing for him.
Absolutely. It's a constant battle against these earthly temptations, even within his own group.
So that's a pretty intense moment. Master versus disciple. How do the others react? Monkey and Sandy.
Well, Monkey King, Sun Wukong, sees the master's furious and immediately steps in.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he grabs Pigsy, gives him a punch, and basically tells him off for annoying the master and making everyone look bad. Classic monkey.
Enforcing the hierarchy.
Totally. And Sandy, Sha Wujing, he just kind of laughs and says Pigsy talks too much.
He often plays the observer, doesn't he?
He does. It's that typical group dynamic, isn't it? The enforcer, the glutton, the quiet one, and the stressed out leader. And what's fascinating is how this personal urgent mission immediately clashes with Ku Yuanwai's generosity.
How does Ku Yuanwai react initially?
He's very polite, almost deferential. He tries to persuade Tang Sanzang to stay, even worries that maybe he did something wrong as a host, caused offense somehow.
So he thinks it's about his hosting first. But that changes, right? The family gets involved.
Oh, yes. It escalates quickly. It moves beyond just polite requests.
Tell me about that.
Well, Ku Yuanwai's wife, the old lady, she steps in. She points out they've already been there half a month.
Okay.
And then she offers to host them for another half month using her own pin money.
Her pin money? That sounds significant.
It really is. For that time, it's her personal funds, maybe hard-earned savings. Offering it up like that is a huge act of personal devotion.
So that really ratchets up the pressure, doesn't it? Emotionally, morally.
Definitely. It's not just the host now. It's the matriarch making a personal sacrifice.
And the sons join in, too.
Right. The two sons, Ku Dong and his brother, they add another layer. They stress that their father has been trying for 20 years to host 10,000 monks, and Tang Sanzang's arrival finally fulfilled this lifelong goal.
So their arrival is like the capstone to this massive family effort.
Exactly. And they even quote a saying, something like, one reaps what one sows. If one doesn't sow, one won't reap.
Yeah,
meaning they want to gain good karma, or merit from hosting these holy men. And guess what? They also offered a host for another half month.
So now it's not just about comfort, it's spiritual. It's about their family's merit.
Precisely. It transforms from simple hospitality into, well, a spiritual transaction. The Ku family isn't just being nice, they're actively seeking karmic reward.
How do you even refuse that?
Yeah.
The client isn't just rude, it's like you're blocking their path to enlightenment or something.
It's an incredibly difficult position, denying their spiritual investment, basically.
You can just picture Tang Sanzang trying to hold firm against all that.
Pigsy is complain.
Pigsy. What does he say?
He basically calls Tang Sanzang too unaccommodating, unreasonable. Doesn't hold back at all.
And let me guess, his reasoning is?
He suggests staying for then maybe a month. He just wants the comfort, the food.
It's so relatable, that immediate desire versus the big goal, like trying to stick to a diet when there's cake right there.
Exactly.
How does Tang Sanzang react to that?
He's furious, scolds Pigsy, totally ignoring the spiritual purpose, the dedication and merit transfer.
Ouch.
And Pigsy's reaction is pretty funny. He actually hits himself in the mouth, muttering, "Don't talk so much, you're speaking again." Like, immediate regret.
That's quite a scene.
But things get tense even with Monkey. Tang Sanzang actually threatens him with the golden fillet spell.
The headache spell. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Monkey immediately hits his knees, begging forgiveness.
So even the mighty Monkey King knows his place here.
It's a stark reminder. Even he is bound by Tang Sanzang's authority and the mission's rules. This whole mess really shows the different personalities, right? The different motivations all clashing.
Absolutely. It's not just Tang Sanzang's resolve being tested. It's how it ripples through the whole group.
Okay, so Tang Sanzang holds firm despite the family's pleas and Pigsy's protests.
Right. Faced with this unwavering resolve and probably the rising tension, Ku Yuanwai finally gives in. Reluctantly.
He agrees they can leave, but not right away.
No, it has to be the next morning.
But just agreeing isn't the end of it for Ku Yuanwai, is it? How does he handle this acceptance?
He doesn't just say, okay, safe travels. No, he immediately starts planning this enormous send-off.
A farewell party.
On a scale you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
It showcases his immense wealth, yes, but also how important this farewell is to him. He orders his staff to write hundreds of invitation slips.
Hundreds? For you?
Neighbors, relatives, then prepare a huge farewell banquet. Get 20 pairs of colored flags, hire musicians, invite monks from the Southern Temple and Taoists from the Eastern Peak Temple.
Wow. So basically mobilizing the entire religious and social community.
Exactly. And all this needs to be ready by, what, 9 to 11 a.m. the next day?
That's an incredible amount of organization. Overnight.
The description is amazing. Frenzied activity all night. Servants running, chefs cooking up a storm, decorators shouting, messengers dashing everywhere, getting sedan chairs, horses ready.
It sounds like chaos, but incredibly efficient chaos.
Yeah, and there's that line, only money can achieve this, or maybe no amount of money is too much.
So the disciples, they start packing up. Budgie's grumbling, obviously.
Of course.
Zhuxing's getting the horses. Wukong gives the master his staff, and he grabs that crucial document, the customs clearance paper.
The Tongwen Wendy, yeah. Very important.
But just as they're about to head out the door, boom, another feast.
Huh, yes.
How does this one stack up? Is it even grander?
Oh, it seems like it. If you think about the whole journey, this isn't just food. It's the grand finale farewell feast.
Okay.
The source really details it. A sea war, this huge hall laid out with Theo, banquets that are somehow even better than before. You get descriptions of high curtains, screens all around, the painting of Yi.
Longevity Mountain and Fortune Sea, right? Symbols of good wishes.
Exactly. Seasonal scrolls, incense.
Yeah.
It's a full sensory experience.
And the food itself, it mentions... See, these colorful decorative platters and tables literally piled with gold.
Well, maybe gold-colored food or dishes, but definitely suggesting immense richness.
Okay.
And those sugar figures, lions and immortals made of sugar.
Wow.
It says his home, even though he's a commoner, is no less grand than a prince's place.
So what does that tell us about him and the town? It's not just him, right?
No, definitely not just him. It shows his incredible wealth and status, sure, but also the community's devotion.
Ah.
The guests are neighbors, relatives, fellow Buddhists, friends, all chanting Buddha's name, bowing. It's like the whole town is embracing them.
A real community send-off.
Totally. With music too, drums, zithers, flutes, singing. A proper public spectacle.
Now, this is where we really see the disciples' personalities come out, especially Baji. Food's involved, so.
Predictably. What does he say to Shaosheng?
His classic line, Orishone. Basically, brother, eat up, load up. Once we leave Ku's place, we won't see food like this again.
He's just so wonderfully direct about his desires.
Completely. Earthy, immediate gratification. That's Baji.
But Shaosheng's reply, it's surprisingly philosophical.
It really is. He says, who, imagine, sure, no, outfield.
Something like, brother, what are you saying? The proverb goes, 100 delicacies, once you're full, you stop. There's only a private road, not a private stomach.
Oh. Okay.
It's this simple wisdom, right? True progress isn't about just consuming endlessly. It's knowing when enough is enough. A really sharp contrast to Baji.
Showing that wisdom can pop up anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even from the quiet ones.
But Baji, he's not having it, is he? Claims he can eat enough for 3 days.
Naturally.
And Wukong has to jump in, the practical one, reminding them they need to, you know, walk after this.
Yeah. Hey, remember walking. It sounds like this chaotic little family moment right before they leave.
It really does. And it's not just for laughs, is it?
No, not at all. It shows their individual struggles perfectly. Baji is all about those worldly attachments, food, comfort that the journey is meant to overcome.
Right.
And Wukong is the disciplined one, always trying to keep them focused on the actual mission.
So they have this quick meal. Baji wolfs down, what, 5 or 6 bowls?
Yep. And stuffs his sleeves with bread and cakes for later.
Oh my goodness, what an image. And then they finally manage to leave.
Finally.
And the send-off outside is just as nuts as the feast inside. Flags, canopies, musicians.
Well, yeah, colorful flags, jeweled canopies, drummers, monks, Taoists joining in. It's a huge procession.
Ku Yuanwei is even apologizing to people who arrived late because Tang Monk was in a hurry.
Right. The text describes Hu Cixi, thunderous music, flags blocking the sun, crowds, chariots.
Wow.
It says it was grander than Tulun, being surrounded by pearls and jade and like luxurious hidden comforts. The whole city turned out.
And it doesn't just stop at the gate, does it?
No, it keeps going for miles. Groups of monks playing Buddhist music. Taoists playing their daos, their mysterious tunes, outside the city walls.
More farewells.
Yep, at the 10-mile pavilion, there's another stop. More food, more drinks. Ku Yuanwei is actually crying, begging Tang Monk to come back and stay longer.
That's intense devotion, and Tang Monk makes him a promise.
The significant one, yeah. He promises Ku Yuanwei he'll praise his virtue to the Buddha himself.
Okay.
And that he'll definitely return to thank him in person. For the audience back then, that's a serious vow. It shows that mutual respect, that commitment.
It carries weight.
Absolutely. It's not just being polite.
But then the shift. After all that, they finally get properly on their way, maybe, what, 20, 25 kilometers down the road?
40 or 50 lines.
Uh-huh.
As evening starts to fall.
And bang, the comfort just evaporates. What's the effect of that sudden change?
It's a classic narrative move.
Yeah.
The text even points it out.
Which means...
when joy reaches its peak, sorrow starts to emerge.
Yeah.
Or from a place of pleasure, sadness is encountered. It's this immediate jarring contrast.
Right.
From total luxury and adoration to the harsh reality of the road. It's like a splash of cold water for them and for us reading it.
And guess who starts complaining immediately?
Let me guess. Baji.
You got it. Instantly complaining about leaving the good life.
Yep. Grumbling about giving up. You know, ready-made meals and cool houses.
It's almost funny how fast he flips.
It is. And Tang Monk snaps at him, calls him a wicked beast, basically.
Oh.
Yeah, reminds him sharply. We need to see Buddha. Get the scriptures. Then he promises him endless food from the imperial kitchen after they succeed, almost bribing him.
Huh. So it was this constant battle, right? Spiritual focus versus worldly desires.
Exactly. Playing out right there between them.
So night's falling, Baji's still whining, and Wukong spots somewhere they might be able to rest.
Yeah.
Ruined archway.
A dilapidated archway, yeah. With faded words. Aqua Monastery. Sounds pretty run down.
Forgotten.
Seems like it. But Tang Monk's being knowledgeable, he makes a connection.
To mythology.
Yeah, he identifies Huaguang Bodhisattva, says he was a disciple of the fiery five-light Buddha. Got demoted after fighting some demon.
Okay, so there's lore attached.
Right. And Tang Monk expects maybe there's still a caretaker, someone living there. It kind of grounds their physical struggle in this bigger mythical world.
So they go in hoping for, I don't know, a roof, Some shelter.
Some basic sanctuary, yeah.
Yeah.
But what they find is just ruins.
Really bad.
Collapsed corridors, tilted walls, no sign of anyone. Just weeds, overgrown bushes, total decay. Not the refuge they needed.
Oh, man. And then, just to make things worse.
The weather turns. Okay. Of course it does.
Let me guess. Rain.
Heavy rain.
Huh.
Heavy rain. Trigger Jack. Yeah. Black clouds overhead, pouring rain.
So they're stuck in this wreck of a building getting rained on.
Pretty much. They have to huddle wherever they can find a bit of shelter from the wind and rain.
Mm-hmm.
The text says they spend a sleepless night just sitting or standing.
Ugh.
And staying quiet, too, so they don't attract demons or evil spirits. It's a really grim picture. A stark reminder of just how dangerous and uncomfortable this journey actually is.